Pamela Petro is my latest nostalgia interview guest, and it was wonderful to catch up with Pamela, who's an American author, artist and teacher based in Massachusetts. Pamela has just published a memoir called The Long Field, in which we learn about her passion for Wales as an American based around the concept of hiraeth. Now, Pamela did an MA in Lampeter in the word and the visual imagination back in the mid-1980s, and she talks about how she never got over her so-called Welsh thing. In the last 35 years, she has been back something like 28 times. Now, Lampeter has affected her in a way no other place has, and Pamela talks about how she felt instantly at home there and about being comfortable on the margins, looking critically at the centre. She felt that she was in touch with the world in this intimate place, and she talks about using our own stories as a jumping-off place to a universal plane. We learn about the importance of hiraeth, which might be thought of as a form of homesickness and longing, quite similar, I guess, in some ways to nostalgia, and as the presence of absence, perhaps a longing for the self that we once were. Now, we hear about the time that a man appeared out of a manhole in Lampeter wearing a German pith helmet and a sheep wandering in the library. And we learn about Pamela's background growing up in New Jersey. She talks about the search for that in-between state and about how one is always imagining what we don't have. To miss something is the springboard to imagination. And Pamela is happy to be in that liminal space. It's the looking forward, say, to Christmas or a holiday that's more important than the event itself. And we find out why Pamela looks forward to the shortening of the light in winter, and we consider all of these motifs via the endings of films like The Shawshank Redemption, Shirley Valentine, and Local Hero. Now, at the end of the interview, we discuss how negative experiences allow us to grow. We talk about how loss might be deemed to be the most important thing in life. And we discover that Pamela carries the past with her all the time. And we find out what would happen if she could choose between going to the past or going to the future. It was wonderful to catch up for my latest nostalgia interview with Pamela Petro. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Pamela Petro for my latest nostalgia interview. And Pamela, we were just saying that Lampeter, I think for both of us, completely changed our lives.
This is true. Before I say that, though, it is an enormous pleasure to be here. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for inviting me. Really,
an absolute thrill, I have to say, because just to give everyone a bit of context, we met in March of this year in 2021 when you gave a book reading.
St. David's Day.
Yeah, it couldn't be more perfect. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yes, because this is how I get to promote my book. The Lampeter Society had kindly asked me to do a reading and conversation about my new book, which is coming out in September, on September 14th from Little Toller Books. And it's called The Long Field, A Memoir, Wales, and the Presence of Absence. And it centers on my passion for Wales and what it means to be an American who felt at home in this place and then have to leave that place. And that led to my thinking about the idea of hiraeth in Welsh. And I view Wales and my experiences through that lens.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because Lampeter, for so many people, has completely changed, galvanized, transformed, but often not there. It's the years afterwards or the decades afterwards that you realize that there's some residue, that it's made this mark. And you're trying to, you know, you either shake it off and say, oh, it was all in the past, which is the last thing I do. Or you say, hang on a minute, this is instrumental to my very sort of sense of self and my being.
Right. You have to say this is going to be a part of my life. When I was there for a little over a year getting my MA, it was an MA called The Word and the Visual Imagination, which is exactly what you do when you're very programmed about what you want to do in life. Everybody thought I was nuts to be going to Wales to do this word and image studies kind of master's. You know, what are you going to do with that? But when I got home after that year and a half, my family started talking about my Welsh thing. And my aunt, this is in my book, my aunt would call my mom and say, is Pam over her Welsh thing yet? And I never got over it. And when I finally said, I guess it was about a year and a half later that I was going back for a visit, my parents both looked at each other and laughed and said, we didn't think it would take this long. And since then, I had the count. I think in 35 years, I've been back 28 times, something like that.
Yeah. And one thing that I really picked up from when we met back in March is that you're well traveled. I think you said, was it Italy, I think, that you've spent some time in? Is that right? Italy,
France.
France, yeah. And so you've been to France, and obviously you're American. We'll I'm sure that will come up in just a minute. But Lampeter, unlike all the other places where you studied, for example, for your first degree, is somewhere that has affected you in a way that no other place has quite managed to do.
It's a curious thing, isn't it? All my teenage years and early adulthood, I thought France was the place I wanted to be. And I was just like headed to Paris. I had to go to Paris. And I did for my junior year abroad. And I love Paris. And that's where I met my life partner. And it was great. But Paris seemed like a place that was complete in itself in some way. And I don't mean that in the sense that Wales needed me to complete it in any way, but it was very sure of itself and finished in a sense, in the idea of culturally confident, maybe. I didn't sense a welcome there, let's say. And then 2 years later, I went to Wales. And I felt instantly at home in a way. This place that had such a checkered past, in a sense, it was officially in a post-colonial status, but, or maybe it was still colonial then, you could say, before 1993, before the Welsh Language Act. I was there in 83, 84. It was a place that was still becoming as I was becoming. And it was a place that wasn't in the center, as Paris is the center of France and the center of its own universe. Wales was on the margin. Growing up during an anti-establishment time, growing up during the Vietnam War in the States and Watergate, I was comfortable on the margins looking critically at the center. And this place, and I was also unsure of my own sexuality. Was I straight? Was I gay? I also felt decentered in a way. And that's just kind of the cultural sense I had. But then there was the landscape, which hit me right between the eyes. I got there and saw in front of my eyes this place that I had always imagined would be my landscape. I had never seen it before, any place I had ever been, including England and Scotland. And just the clarity of the West Walian river valleys and hills and the way the geography added up to a single holistic view gave me a sense of my place on the planet that I had never experienced before. And I felt at home.
It's really funny, isn't it? Because I'm from Cardiff, and yet when I went to university, so many of my contemporaries either stayed in Cardiff and continued to live at home, or they went eastwards. Now, when I went to Lampeter, you know, there was a bit of a joke, like, well, you know, you're going to a place that's got no traffic lights, actually, in those days, people would say, oh, it's only got one set of traffic lights. And I said, no, I want to correct you, it doesn't have any. So that reinforced their sense that this was a very marginal place. But you see, the trouble is, it, like you, in going there, something eye-opening happened. There was something very mystical about the place. And it was kind of, I think the thing is, whereas if you go to Paris, for example, you know, you're going to this big metropolis, you're going to this big hub of social and, you know, activity. But in a place like Lampeter, it's like the world went to Lampeter, because you'd have students from every corner of the world. It was a small place, but it was there's an intimacy there. You could get to know people. I mean, for good or ill, you'd see the same people every day. So you'd have those conversations. You'd pick up from conversations that you had the night before with somebody from Germany or Australia or Canada. And then, you know, you'd find that those deep and rewarding conversations would happen in a way that could never happen. If you meet somebody in Paris, the chances are you'll never see them again. So in a funny way, the reason why people thought that Lampeter, yes, as you're right, is a marginal place, it's middle of nowhere. Well, some of those things are true. But you see, that's also the very thing that gave it such an important sense of identity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something I was aware of from the very start, that sense of intimacy, as you say, and an intimacy not just... that was international in scope. I knew people from all over the world, Germans especially. There was a big group of Germans there when I was there. And I felt like I was in touch with the world, but in this intimate place that I absolutely loved, both in the terms of the countryside itself, and the people at the college. And what's really interesting is when I was there as a student, I really didn't intersect with the town, Lampeter the town, and townspeople and Welsh speakers and the culture of Wales as much as I did the culture of the college, which is fascinating and bizarre and international and wonderful. But I had to go back. And that's when I started to make friends outside the college and started to become really interested in learning Welsh and in reading Welsh literature and learning legends and all of that.
Because that's what happens in so many parts of life, isn't it? Because, you know, I spent so much of my life, I suppose, through my academic study, looking at lots of sort of theoretical constructs, and you're sort of looking at all the, you know, the big thinkers, and you do all the sort of the official stuff, you know, you read the books and you regurgitate them. And then there's a point where you say, but why am I doing this? And right. you realize that the thing that matters more than anything, and I suppose that's what we're doing, for example, in this podcast, is, you know, you're talking about the reasons why you are shaped. So it's not just about, you know, what's your book about? It's about, you know, what are your motives for writing it? And that, I think, is where you intersect with people. And that's where you have this shared communal sense of identity and memory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think unconsciously for a while, but then I realized what was driving me writing this book. This book took 7-8 years to write, another, I'll say 7 years to write, 2 years to find a publisher and then be printed. My first book, Travels in an Old Tongue, about traveling around the world, trying to practice Welsh as a learner with people who either were from Wales but had emigrated elsewhere or were posted elsewhere, or people from, say, Japan, academics in Japan who met once a month to speak Welsh because there was a Celtic craze. The idea was not just for me to work on my Welsh, but to come up with a sense of Wales from afar, to piece together this place. So that was what the book ostensibly was about. But there was a reviewer in the Times who said, yes, this is all well and good, but why is this American woman writing this book? Why? She doesn't really answer that question. And that, I realized, is what was my springboard into this new book, The Long Field. And Hiraeth was what answered that question. And I realized about halfway through, I was writing to answer that question. Yeah. Why? That why. And my name means why in Welsh, I would just like to say.
So that sort of, you know, intrigue, it's interesting, isn't it? That self-reflexivity that, you know, carries you about, because I suppose particularly because I work in religious studies, and of course you always get the question, so, you know, are you religious? And, you know, and then you've got the whole sort of, you know, we've all, you know, been there, done that. But the odd thing is that if you've got a passion to do something, you know, you're going to do it anyway. People might sometimes say, you know, but you work on this project, you know, you may not get any money for it, or you don't know, or the rewards might come in years to come, you know. So, you know, why do you do what you do? And sometimes, you know, sometimes, you know, there's all sort of, oh, it's part of my job, I have to be seem to be doing this sort of thing. But there are some projects, like the one that you're talking about with Hiraeth, where it's obvious that you know, that comes, that's a story that you have to tell, irrespective of, you know, it's not as though anyone's commissioning you to say, said, you have to write this book. This is your project. And how, I mean, and I can't underestimate or what do I mean? Overestimate the extent to which when you gave that talk in March, people were, you know, we, myself included, were just listening and just thinking, you know, wow, what you've just summed up, although your own way through this is obviously unique and different because, you know, obviously you came from America and you were there.
But it's universal at the same time.
It was universal. Do you want to say a bit more about that and how Hayrife plays such a big role in your thinking?
Well, this is something I beat into my students all the time, my writing students. You can tell your story and you should tell your story, but the idea isn't to get your story out there. It's to go use your story as a jumping off place to a universal plane that everybody understands. And until you do that, you're writing for yourself. You're not really writing for others. In fact, I have to tell someone this on Friday. That's another story. But Hierife. In the book I talk about in the very beginning, I saw a poster on campus and everything at the time, the new big thing when I was there was posters had to be bilingual. And that was recently instituted. And someone put up a poster, I can't remember what it was for, the literary society or whatever, and Hierife hadn't been translated. They just used the same word in English. And I was dating this guy and I said, I was waiting for him and he came and I said, what does that word mean? And he said, I don't know, I'm English. Don't ask me. But that I remember that was the first time I encountered it. And then it took me years to become interested in it and realize that my feelings about Lampeter coalesced in this word. And it means, it translates to English very imperfectly. There's no cognate in English. It translates as homesickness or longing. It's only cognate. It's only exact cognate. So say the linguists, and I'm no linguist, so I don't know. I'm just taking them on their word, is the Portuguese saudade. Saudade is defined in a song as the presence of absence. And to me, that came the closest to explaining Hierife, where you are not fully occupying the present moment, because your brain is occupied fiercely by something in the past that you've left behind, that you can't get back to, that or you're a dream that you had in the past that's no longer pertinent to your life, but you can't let go, or a place in the future that you wish you could be, but can't reach. It's Hierife is that liminal space between, if you want to call the present liminal, it's that sense of longing. And I think we could say it's homesickness. That you could say that, but then you have to investigate what the word home means. And home then becomes charged. It becomes a much more complex idea than what we think we mean when we say home. As in, I'm going home, means I'm going back to my house. But home, I think, can mean all kinds of things. And if we take that into account, then yeah, Hierife can mean homesickness.
Yeah.
But home could be a feeling. Home could be a person. Home could be a time. You know. So Hierife is very complex. It's like mercury. You know, you try to push on it, and it squirts out in all different directions.
No, I think you summed it up brilliantly, because that's the very sort of journey that I'm trying to work through. Obviously, I do my work on nostalgia, but again, that sense of a longing for something that, although it's ostensibly about the past, it is also about a deficit in the present, in the sense that there's this sense of there's something missing. There's something that I want to cling onto. And that notion of home is interesting, because, you know, I always thought, you know, I'll give you an example. I went to a Lampeter reunion in 2018, and in my mind, and perhaps I was a bit naive in thinking this, but I somehow imagined that suddenly all the people that I'd been to Lampeter with in the 1990s would suddenly reappear, that suddenly I'd see them all again, because I somehow thought that I'm going back there for the first time in so long, and that we were all making this journey together. So I was a bit shocked and disappointed to discover that actually there were lots of people there, but very few of them were contemporaries of mine. There were lots from the 70s, even 60s and 70s graduates, quite a few 80s, but fewer from, so if anything, I was one of the youngest there. And I thought, gosh, and I was there, you know, a quarter of a century ago. So that that that's not the right word for it, but certainly wrong-footed me to begin with. But then I thought about this. And of course, what is interesting is that every time I went around Lampeter, and of course, a lot of the buildings looked the same, some of them didn't look the same. So there was always that sense of comparing and contrasting, how, you know, and I'd have these memories of 30 years ago, but also they were slightly distorted memories and also slightly skewed by the fact that the place is the same but different.
Right.
And then I realized, even if I'm not in Lampeter, the people who made a difference there, whether I meet them online or meet them in Cardiff or wherever it might be, we met in Lampeter 30 years ago, and home is not then just Lampeter. It's the home is the people. The home is the
community. The home is the people, of course. And sometimes you can go back to that place, but those people aren't there, as you say. Or the place is different, or there's a hugely creative aspect, I think, to Hiraeth and nostalgia. And we should talk about the difference between the two, if there is indeed a difference, I don't know. Is how we, anything that matters to us that we hold in our memories, we galvanize, we change. I say in the book, it's like carbon becoming a diamond under the earth. We hold so tight and fiercely that it changes. It becomes, memory becomes a diamond in a way. And it's an idealized version of what happened, because it's infused with us. It's a way, I've often thought that going back to these places or just the act of feeling Hiraeth is a way of longing for the self that we once were, or this idealized version is infused with us. It's always about us in the end. I think we can't ever get beyond that we infuse our memories with our own longings and desires and imagination.
Because I meet some people who will say, I can't go back. I was there and it made a huge difference. They'll talk passionately about their time there, but will also say that was a long time ago. And they're worried that if they go back, what they're going to see is something that's not really as they remember it. And they don't want that to be their most recent memory. And they hear things about Lampeter as well. Oh, it's not as it used to be. It's not the same size that it used to be. And so in that sense, people don't want to be let down.
People are protecting that.
Yeah,
that place.
I get that. But then there's yourself and now more latterly me, because I was a bit like that. I think for years, I was there for so long. I was there for 10 years. I kind of needed to step away and then also work out exactly, you know, how all those pieces of the jigsaw fitted together. But in your case, as you said, you've been back 28 times. Now I find this really interesting, because in going back, I mean, I suppose there's a point now where, irrespective of, you know, there might be an occasion you go back and you think, oh, you know, this is not my most felicitous visit or something. But there is obviously something there that is now, this is ingrained in you. And that's what I'm fascinated by, that you, I'm guessing that although you don't live there, and maybe you have no desire to live there, although that's something that we can touch on, but the fact is you have to visit, even if it's only for a liminal, for a temporary period. And that I find really interesting, because it's what it then does, the afterglow, if you like, of going there, mm-hmm. in terms of how it fills the rest of your life and the rest of your space.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a moment where I usually rent a car in Swansea or Cardiff, say, and I drive up the A485 and I'm going up the Tyvee Valley and north of Carmarthen. At some point halfway to Lampeter, there's a certain moment around a certain curve where I look and can see the hills knitted together. And I feel like I always have the same thought. How can I live the rest of my life without this view? How do I survive without this place? And yet for years and years, it's not just not practical to live there. My partner Teach has a tenured position in college here, and for years we have family, and we for years we cared for our parents, and So it just wasn't practical to live there. But I have been back so many times that I feel like I've evolved along with the town. And that is incredibly important in avoiding what you were talking about, that sense of disappointment. Because I see it now not just as a place that I was a student, but as a place that I now bring students, because I do this summer school, the Dylan Thomas Summer School in Creative Writing. And for 2 weeks, the end of May, beginning of June, which I've been doing since 2014, except for 20 and this year, because of the pandemic. But I feel that that's allowed me to have a kind of double vision of the place. I still see myself there as a kid, as a 23-year-old kid, but now I'm bringing undergrads and postgrads and just adult writers from the States to Lampeter to have this experience. And I'm in a different role. So the town has grown, but I've grown too. And I feel like I still have a place there in a way as an adult person that I wouldn't if I just kept going back, living off my student memories. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you mentioned your partner as well. Now, has she visited Lampeter? So has she ever accompanied you? Or is this something that you absolutely sort of have to do in a very kind of, be careful how you answer this.
This is very funny. Yes. Marguerite has spent a lot of time in Lampeter. The first time we went for 6 weeks, we stayed in a professor friend's house. He was away for the summer, and it rained every single day, every single day. And Marguerite learned the Welsh phrase, "Mae hi'n oer y bore yma." It's cold this morning, because it was freezing in the house. There was no sun. And it took years to convince her that the sun actually shone. And then we came back for the summer of 95 for a month then. And there was nothing but sun. It was hot. The thing with Marguerite is she is fiercely car sick, motion sick. She is incredibly sensitive to motion. And the Welsh roads just are a killer to her. It's just so hard for her to be there. And in fact, one of the arcs in the book is that Marguerite comes, it tells our story as well, again, through the lens of Hiraeth, but sort of an aside from that, she's there in the beginning when we're young, essentially, and then she's not there for 25 years because her memory of Lampeter is being carsick. And finally, in the end, she comes back in the epilogue and she joins me at the summer school. And I drive very slowly. And she's okay.
But just before we started, you were talking about this surreal experience of, were you walking down the road in Lampeter one day and suddenly something cropped up from outside, was it from a manhole?
Yes. One of the first days I was there, I was walking across campus and a manhole rose in front of me, and out of it peeked a guy in a German pith helmet. Maybe it was World War I, World War II, who knew? And he looked around and then slowly brought the manhole cover down. And I thought, what kind of place have I just come to? And then things like that happened over and over again, over and over. You know, my friend Annie finding a sheep in the library and wandering the stacks. And other people had, it turns out, had seen the sheep, but nobody thought it was odd. I talk in the book about how, not just in memory, but in life, Lampeter for me was something like Mercury. It was a state in between that I was learning about post-structural theory. I was learning about semiotics. But I was also learning how to live in a rural place, how to dip a sheep, how to deal with rural plumbing, how to pull a pint in a pub. I had never known these things before. And so I was weaving both. And then there were these extraordinary experiences that seemed, were they really true? Were they really happening? And I was reading the Mabinogion about, and these images were sticking in my head of a tree that was half aflame, half green with leaves, sheep that would go through a river, enter a river as white and come out as black, women made of flowers. And it all seemed possible in both life and then later in memory. It's a weaving together of literature and lived experience that I've never come across anywhere else. It was very heady magic, you could say, especially when you're 23 and defining yourself. Yeah. And it becomes seared, a place, this place becomes seared into your DNA in a way.
Yeah. Well, do you want to say a little bit about your time before Lampeter? So obviously you were in America, and I'm interested in the counterpoint here. You know, because you think of all those like great Frank Capra films and the sort of, you know, Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington. You've got the whole, you know, you go from the country to the city and then back to the country afterwards. But I think everyone has a bit of that in them. As I came from the city, and some people, I think, when I went to university, a few people at school thought it was a bit of a retrograde step to go from the big city of Cardiff, somewhere completely rural. You know, why would you go that way rather than the other way? But those friends of mine who stayed in Cardiff, and many of my friends did, were still living with their parents. And there was just something to me that also didn't seem right to me, because I've always been very close to my parents. But I think there was a point where I knew, and it happened at 18, that I had to sort of make a new start and find myself. And I did, and Lampeter facilitated that. But in your case, I'm fascinated by this journey of because obviously your own family were surprised that you were going, and they saw it as a bit of a fad. But you didn't get that Welsh thing out of your system, and of course you never did, and that probably reinforced your sense also that this was momentous. But I'm fascinated in this journey from America to Lampeter.
Now that's a really good question, because it certainly plays into why Lampeter was so important. I grew up in New Jersey, which is of course the butt of every other American joke. It talk about a marginal place. It's the suburban place next to New York. New York City was about 45 minutes away. And so everything in New York is the center. Talk about the hub. You know, it's exciting. It's dangerous. It's wonderful. And then there's suburban New Jersey, which is safe and dull. And because it's safe and dull, all I ever wanted to do was leave. I was convinced I was born into the wrong place. I should have been born. I was a total teenage romantic. You know, the Brontes and Daphne du Maurier, that's what I grew up on. And I was sure I should have been born in a castle in Cornwall or the Yorkshire Moors. That's where my mind was. But that allowed me to dream of leaving this place. Also, it's a very built environment. Suburban New Jersey gets more and more crowded. I'm from Essex County, which is very densely populated. When I grew up, there was still farmland nearby, and that's completely gone now with housing estates. There's a scene in the book, which is true, of me digging in my mom's garden, looking for some other time, looking for what came before us. And I'm just a little kid. And my mom, I think, was freaked out. Like, why would I do that? Why wasn't I satisfied with a beautiful summer afternoon? And I was also, I talked to my dad when I was a kid about, I couldn't articulate it like I can now, but why the street we lived on, why was it a circle with a road connecting us to a larger road? Why it seemed so artificial. It seemed so planned by people. Why wasn't what I would say now, why didn't it grow up organically on the land? And he was an engineer, so he explained it all, but that it still felt I was unsatisfied. There was, when you talked about how to get from point A to point B, you gave street directions. And then I went to Brown University in a city, and I went to Paris. And then I spent a year in Washington, D.C. All Cities. And then I got to Lampeter. And what I talked about before, that sense of being in a place where I could see how the land was literally geologically knitted together, gave me, and when you gave a direction, you might say, well, ford the river. And then when you get to the bottom of the valley, start heading up the hill. That's where we are. I felt like people had a place on the earth. We weren't just sitting on top of it. And it also gave me a sense of scale that we are so small in this big, on this big planet. And we matter. We're only one consideration in all of these factors that make up home. No, it's not all human concerns. And I think being around animals, smelling their smells, seeing them every day. Part of the time I was there, I lived on a farm. That it all broadened my view of my world, that beyond the human, beyond the a human-centric kind of experience. And people talked about the sea, and they talked about where the wind came from and where it blew to. And I wanted to be part of all this. And I talk about this in the book too, that I was dating this guy, and it seemed so unsatisfactory to me to be linked to one human when this world, this natural world was around me that felt so much more important to get to know, to participate in. And so that relationship didn't last.
Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because sometimes, whether it's relationships or people, you know, you have all of these sort of expectations when you're really young about what, you know, my own students, you know, often it's fascinating to hear what, you know, what they want to be when they grow up, sort of thing. But, mm-hmm. but in reality, you see, there are often those things from childhood, from when you're really, really young, that what you were saying about digging up in the garden, you know, wanting to know about the past, it's interesting. That may have freaked out your mother at the time, but sometimes I think we all have in us, and I'm the same. My 6-year-old self, I mean, I've been keeping diary since I was 9, but wow. my really young self is in so many ways not the slightest bit different from now. Obviously, you know, I was a child, but the interest, the music that I followed, the same questions, the same sort of way of compartmentalizing things and collecting data, you know, channeled into different sort of forms of exploration through, you know, academic study or whatever. But also in those days, I used to write down the charts and had all the sort of like great love of music and radio. But it's interesting that that follows you through. And you're right that sometimes it can feel really limiting if you've got this sort of sense of adventure and this sense of calling and purpose, and then to be pinned down in one place, one community with one relationship, even, you know, when there is all these sort of discoveries ahead that you don't want your wings to be clipped.
Absolutely. And I think I talk about this too. This is everything I'm saying is from the book in one way or another, which is great because it's all there. Edward Said has, and I'm not going to get it right, but a quote about exiles being in a bad place, that they have to be exiled, but they also develop a view that he calls contrapuntal. They're aware of more than one place in the world. And I think that is one of the things I was unconsciously searching for. Marguerite grew up, she's Brazilian American. Her mom is Brazilian. Her dad is American. And she was born in the States, but spent most of her childhood and early teen years in Brazil, and then came back to the States for the rest of high school and college. And she was always between places. And it was a very uncomfortable place when she was young. Since then, she's realized it's given her two languages and two cultures. And to be in that semi-uncomfortable but very rich space in between is what I always craved. And I didn't have that. I had a very American rooted childhood without the kind of longing for ancestral pasts that so many Americans have, because those traditions weren't strong in my family, really. So I had to find that in between place myself, which in the book I call the long field. The long field is that in-between place, that place of hiraeth, that you're neither here nor there. If I'm in Wales, I'm thinking about the States. If I'm in the States, I'm thinking about Wales. So I needed to create that contrapuntal view, which I find the creative place, because you're always imagining that which you don't, the one you don't have, or doesn't have to be just bilateral. It could be many places. But I think this is the edge of hiraeth that I haven't talked about yet, which I don't know if you would say nostalgia also has. When we think of nostalgia, I mean, you know, it's all semantics. We put these words on feelings and they squirt out from underneath. But when you're missing something, I think that's when we start idealizing, but that's also when we start creating. And it's the real springboard to imagination. And I think it's what I talk about in the book. It's the wellspring of Welsh culture, from Mabinogion onward, to invent when you don't have. And I think maybe that's the wellspring of most creativity. But to my Welsh friends, hiraeth, possibly unlike nostalgia, which I think of as more benign, my Welsh friends see hiraeth as negative. It's for the person who experiences it, it may be both pleasurable or painful or both at the same time. But when you're thinking about it as a concept, they see it as negative in that it pins Wales and Welsh culture in a place where it's always looking backward rather than generating new life, new vision, looking forward. To me, I see it probably because I'm American, which is so odd. I spent so much time wanting to be Welsh, but now I'm happy to be in between. But I see it as generative. I see it as a place where we do generate new vision, new creativity, where we invent because of loss, because of absence. And I think that's the reflex, that's the most important part of hiraeth to me.
Yeah, and I think what you say there about the liminality is crucial, because if you're living in Lampeter and you never leave Lampeter, then you have a very sort of a clear but very fixed, and perhaps in some cases sort of narrow understanding of what's going on. It's when you leave, and this goes for anywhere, even a job sometimes, it's when you're not at work and you reflect on work, or, you know, it's those in-between spaces. Now, I always think of this is more of a crass example, but, you know, it's like leaving work, but rather than going home directly, you stop at the supermarket, or in my case, go to the cinema. But those are not accidental, and they're those, you know, and I realized during lockdown, because I was missing the commute. Now, people would say to me, oh, at least you're saving all this time. Hey, you're not commuting in the morning and evening. Oh, you got all this extra time. And I thought, I'm less productive. Why was I less productive during lockdown? And that commute wasn't an inconvenience. The drive to work wasn't something I had to tolerate, because I could have worked from home. You know, nobody is right. Making me go into work, but how productive I feel because I'm doing that and what I do. And in the car, I've got all my old digitized now music tapes from when I was at Lampeter. So I listened to all this stuff recorded off the radio. So it's all there. And the journey there is me going back and negotiating through the music, all the thoughts, the memories of those days. So what you're outlining is really important, that, you know, presence and absence, the two of them, you can't do without them. You have to go away in order to come back.
Absolutely. Oh, I couldn't agree. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's those liminal moments of the day that they seem like they're the sort of interstitial connecting tissues of the things that really matter. But in some ways, they're the things that matter. For me, it's the shower. I'll be like writing in my office, and I get stuck. I run into a wall. I want to bang my head against the desk. I do bang my head against the desk. And then I think, you know what? I haven't taken a shower yet. And I go in the shower and I start thinking about something else. what shampoo will I use today? Kind of thing. And as my mind drifts off to other topics, that's when, in those in-between moments, ideas come around. That when I'm not focused on something, when I'm really sort of looking at something else, something slips in from the side. And that's when I understand suddenly. I can't tell you how much of the book came to me in the shower or taking the dog for a walk.
Or an example I would give could be the way in which, if I'm working on something, whether it's marking a set of essays or if I'm writing a book, it's the amount of time that in those in-between moments, you go on the internet, you check your email, and suddenly your mind, you've got things happening in, you know, I always used to think that if I was driving a car, what would distract me most is having the radio on. But actually, yes, in having the radio on, that completely enables, you know, the longer the journey, the better. You're in this other space and it gives you so much creativity.
I totally understand that. I absolutely agree. And that when I'm writing, the thing I do is play Free Cell, the card game Free Cell. And I'll get to a point, even if I'm not stuck, I sense I'm just getting a little weary. I do that. And it's not like shutting down my mind. My mind is still problem solving. But there's no weight attached to the problems. It's just a card game. But then, so I'm still going through the paces, but there's no pressure. And then I come back to work and I feel rejuvenated. I feel ready to come back.
Yeah, it's a bit of Shirley Valentine. If you know the film and the stage play.
Oh my God, I haven't thought about that in years. Yes,
because you see what I thought, because I remember watching the film Pauline Collins. What a brilliant performance! And when I saw that film, the film version, you know, let's say I saw it 15, 20 years ago, and what I remember the most is that almost there was something a little bit anticlimactic when she actually goes to Greece, because it's the setup. Yes. and you know that there's something wrong in Liverpool, in her home and the family, the way that her family treat her, that she's needing and searching for something else and she can't quite pinpoint it. When she actually goes to Greece, of course, she never leaves. Now that in itself is interesting, but you need that counterpoint. It's you couldn't just have the film set in Greece or the Shawshank Redemption. You know, do you, you need the idea of, say, Watanabe, even if you don't actually make it to the beach at the end? Maybe it's the journey there. Maybe the film is diminished by actually finishing on the beach rather than the idea of the beach.
Oh, it's the idea of the beach that matters most. Well, I just came back from holiday, right? I was 2 weeks in Maine. And it's the looking forward. This, every kid knows this. It's the looking forward to Christmas. That's more important than Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. Christmas Eve is more exciting than Christmas. Yeah. Looking the week before going on holiday is mm-hmm. the best week mm-hmm. because you're anticipating it all. Mm-hmm. Then, and you go, it's great. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as you get there, and this is an aspect of Hiraeth as well, part of your mind knows it will end.
Yeah.
And it's that awareness that we humans deal with. One example I give in the book is of my friend Julio from Portugal, who has lived here for years and years and years. And when he used to go home to see his parents, his mom would burst into tears as soon as he got there. And he'd say, "Oh, mom, don't cry. I'm here." And she'd say, "No, I know, but you'll be leaving in 10 days. And so she's already unhappy. It's that humans can know. I think all of this is about not being able to occupy the present moment for good and for ill.
Yeah. No, actually, you just made me think, because it was a few years ago, I wrote a book on Christmas and I was trying to work out. And the reason I wrote it is because I could never work out what Christmas was, because it's this.
Oh, I have to read this book.
Yeah. Well, it was called Christmas's Religion. And it was actually looking at how the religious bit, it's not the nativity or the church going, but it's actually all the other, the activity.
It's religion, it's private religion. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's what it is.
Yeah. And I was always finding that it's this anticipation of something. And this is what you just said there about how, you know, no sooner has something arrived than you're on to the next thing. For me, it was always this huge build up to Christmas, you know, and all the expectations and the guilt as well. You know, have I bought enough presents for my family, or am I making the most of it, or have I, you know, am I honoring the family or the festival itself, whatever angle you're coming from. And then it's Christmas Day itself, the big day that you've been getting to this, and then on the radio or the TV you've got all these pre-recorded programs, you think, oh, that's a bit climactic. But then you have all the trailers on the TV for all the spring schedule. So Christmas Day, you have this massive build-up, and they'd say, coming up in the spring, coming to a TV near you in February. And I was just like, no, what you've done, for me, that's the equivalent of being at a magic show, and the magician then, you know, you're all entranced by this, and then the magician shows the tricks, and you think, exactly. Oh, actually, you're not, you know, you're not really a magician. You're just, you know, you're an actor. And you think, exactly. Oh, but actually I wanted to believe in this magic. And now you've actually just said, yeah, let's move on to the next thing. And you're like, no,
that is
this
exactly
moment.
Exactly right. That is exactly right. And it's why the day after Christmas,
yeah,
to go to the pharmacy, all the Christmas stuff is gone and they've put Valentine's Day stuff up. Yeah. And it's the same thing. And it's just like, allow me the moment,
yeah,
please. And this is why, I'll bet you're going to agree with this. I'm not sure. I always, and my friends think I'm perverse, but I look forward to the shortening of the days and the winter solstice, the lead into the winter solstice. Almost, I love summer. I love the long days. Mm. But it's that the shortening of the light allows more room for imagining what's there. And there's something about Advent leading up to Christmas that is more, allows the imagination more room than the actual event itself. I mean, I think all of this is under this big umbrella of Yireth. In my visual work, which is not something you can see in a podcast, but I've started taking what I call dusk pictures. And I went to a writing residency and I would write all day. And at the end of the day, I was sick of it. And I went for a walk in the woods and I brought my camera, but I could never get a good shot because the light was too low all the time. This was in October in the New England woods. And so I got angry at one moment and I moved the camera and it became a blur. And that set off this like 3-year project of going to different places, including Lampeter, and moving the camera at dusk. And all of that was a way of creating an emblem for what we've been discussing, that it was that moment, dusk is that moment where it's a kind of a holistic moment where we've lost some of our vision of what we know is, well, what we can see out there, what our sensory, our optic nerve is telling us. So we have to imagine, but we can also still see some of it. And so it's people and place united in a way that doesn't really happen at other times of the day. And that's what I meant about leading into the winter solstice. It's where you get to imagine more when everything isn't a given.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a way of also what you said about Christmas. You know, it's the lead-in is always better than the actual day, especially when then they pull the rug out from under your feet and tell you,
yeah,
it's over.
Yeah, and the way in which, as you say, in a film, and you're right, because I mentioned The Shawshank Redemption a moment ago, but the original ending of that film was actually the bus, the journey to, say, Wataneo. But actually then the end is the beat. Now, it's a phenomenal and very moving ending. But of course, if your idea of redemption isn't a beach, might look at it and think, oh, it's a bit anticlimactic. So,
like, really, the beach? That's it.
That's it. Oh, great! That's wonderful. But the journey there, because that journey on the bus when Morgan Freeman is looking out the window and he's a free man,
right,
with all the, you know, he doesn't know what's going to be at the end of the journey, and his last words are, "I hope to see my friends someday. I hope." And then you see the beach. But if it had finished on the bus,
to finish on the bus.
Yeah, and it should have.
And that's the point of imagination.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's, I think, that's kind of a commitment to creativity. It's a commitment to all, I think always what we imagine is greater than what we experience. I don't know if that's true.
No.
Imagination is so important.
I suppose another example is, you know, sometimes I remember this happening once. It was an Alan Rudolph film, and I came out of the cinema, and my parents met me. I didn't drive in those days, and called Afterglow, brilliant Julie Christie, very sort of radiant performance.
I don't know that.
And they came away and they said, "Oh, you know, how was the film?" And I said, "Oh, it was remarkable. What was it about?" And then you suddenly realise that you think, I'll be diminishing this film by saying, well, there's this man and they're not in a very good marriage and they have this daughter who's run away and she meets someone else who's dating the plumber. And you're like, and then they're thinking, oh, that sounds a bit rubbish. You're thinking, no, it was the most sublime period I've had. Not how you've just described it. And you're thinking, what? And that's the issue, that to diminish, you know, for example, let's say it's Lampeter. Lampeter can be the fountain point, the encapsulation, the quintessence of all these hopes, dreams or whatever. But when you start demarcating it, somebody might say, oh, it's a bit rural, it's a bit cut off. You know, who'd want to go there?
Right.
You're like, you're right. So missing the point.
You're so missing the point. You can't capture it. It's like being in a wonderful, wonderful vista. Yeah. And taking a picture, and that picture can never get at that, it can never represent all of what that moment was to you. Speaking of films, I have a question for you. Did you see the film Local Hero?
Yes, I did, with Burt Lancaster, 1983.
Yes. Peter Reiger and Burt. A friend just saw it. It had been one of my favorite films of all time, and I'd totally forgotten about it. And something is telling me that it bears on this discussion, but I can't remember it very well.
Yeah.
I'll have to go back and see.
You see, first time I saw it, I didn't get it because everyone had spoken about this ending. And as I recall it, it's, you've got Burt Lancaster, who's the American who goes to Scotland. So he's, well, actually the journey in your case, you have the American who goes to this other land and he goes for the purposes of, like, he's a big like oil conglomerate.
He's kind of, right.
Yeah,
right.
And he wants to sort of
exploit
that.
He wants to develop it in some way.
But then it's the charm of the place that works on him. And it's the ordinariness, the honor, you know, the fact is that these are not, you know, he's used to doing all these deals with big corporate figures. And yet the people in Scotland there, are just, you know, their way of life is different from his. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, I can't remember whether he succeeds or you know, who wins, whether, but
I
when he goes
remember.
Back, and apparently the end, that ending was changed, but apparently he's back in, maybe not New Jersey, but
Peter Reiger goes back home, yeah. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. I remember now.
Yeah.
And that's why that film meant so much to me. Yeah. He goes back home and he walks into his apartment and he puts his shells on the kitchen counter that he picked up in Scotland.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know if that's it, but it hit me so hard that was my experience coming home from Lampeter.
Yeah.
It was, that's when Hiraeth hit me the most, that I was home and everything was so familiar. It's that overwhelming familiarity of who you were before and where you were before.
Yeah.
And the sense of, can I still be the person I was in this other place?
Yeah.
It's not just the place you miss, but who that place allowed you to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I felt like Lampeter allowed me to be somebody more. Somebody
because I remember going back to my parents' house in the holidays when I wasn't at Lampeter, and everything familiar was now defamiliarized, that the bedroom that I was in, which I'd been in for years before going to Lampeter, seemed smaller. Or the doors or the door handles or the shapes or the pictures on them, the stairs, everything was out of proportion and perspective. And it was like the familiar. But having been away, something didn't feel right and nothing had changed.
No, but
what had changed was my interpretation of it. So having been somewhere else and gone back, something, and I could never quite work it out. I was like, I'm home. I'm with my parents again.
But that home isn't your only home now.
Yeah. And I couldn't work out, something didn't feel right. Something didn't look right.
And that home becomes then a spectrum, right? It's not just a place. It's a point on a sliding scale.
Yeah.
And that home, that original home, will always be seen in comparison to other places where you feel at home.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that. I've had that experience where going, like, say, back to my parents' house and everything felt slightly different. But then there's also other times I've gone back where it felt so much the same and so familiar that it feels like it has the power to wipe out everything you've experienced elsewhere. And that, I think, is what Peter Reiger felt at the end of Local Hero.
Yeah.
And that it's terrifying, you know, that you'll always be pulled back.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful, I suppose you see bits of this in The Mission or in Scorsese's film Silence, but you've got this idea of you go, you know, in Local Hero, the idea, and obviously this is different from your own experience, but you go to colonize a place with your own values, but you realize that actually that process can work both ways.
Right.
And it's surreptitious. And suddenly you kind of realize that it's like in life, you can have all these great skills that you can have this theoretical idea about how to teach, or you can read the manuscripts, or like driving a car, you can like read the, you know, you can sort of like follow the code, but actually not in that, unless you're actually in the driving seat, do you then actually know what it entails? And I think that that's the thing, that you imagine that you're going to impact on somebody. My students, you think, you know, when you start off, you think, oh, my job is to teach and their job is to learn. In reality, oh no,
who does the learning?
Who learns? I learn from the students.
It's when I think the worst teachers are the ones who never get out of that perception.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a hierarchy and they're on top, yeah, and they're dispensing knowledge downhill to the students. It doesn't work that way at all. I think I couldn't have written this book until I became a teacher. I think by working with the students, and this is a theory of mine, that only when you dispassionately give yourself to others' work, are you open and not so invested in every word that you can learn about what works, what doesn't work, that you can see that when it's your own work being critiqued, you put up walls, you're defensive. But it's, in a way, it's the gift economy. You give to others and it comes back to you, and that you learn more that way.
Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap up, Pamela, I have to ask, I mean, these are the questions I ask everybody, but I think this is going to be really intriguing in the light of our conversation, because I always ask questions along the lines of, you know, are your memories predominantly positive? But I'm fascinated in the context of all that we've been talking about, and the different layers of reflection that you've been doing and writing about, I mean, to a very profound degree, a very creative degree, you know, are your memories predominantly positive?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think, and in that way, I'm very much aware that, in fact, I was just thinking about this morning. I've been very lucky. I've had a very happy life. You know, problems like everyone has, but the most important things, I had parents who loved me without hesitation. You know, there was, they supported me in everything, including going to Lampeter. So that kind of, that baseline love and acceptance, and then also having a loving relationship over years, over decades. That's the most important thing, and good health and good relationships with my brothers and friends. And place has mattered so much, and I've been so lucky to have found Wales. But also I enjoy my life in Massachusetts, to have relationships and good friends outside of my species, my two dogs. And then a career that's allowed me to express myself. The most important things that I've had to say that I've experienced in life, I've found an outlet for and can share with other people. What's better than that? What is better than that? My three previous books have all been external to me in some way. I've come up with a topic and written about that. But this book is about one of the primary relationships in my life, which is between me and a place. And it took so long to write because it took so long to live. And all of that, I just feel so incredibly lucky that I have very good memories.
Yeah. And do you think it can be, you know, conversely, can it be possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Oh, yes. Yes, because I think negative experiences allow you to become, you know, without negative experiences, you can't create, you have to find a creative way past those negative experiences. Mm. And that allows you to grow and become something else. In the a very, very clear example of that is that I had been a travel writer, a travel journalist for a great part of my career, from my late 20s into my early 40s. And it started to feel increasingly like a straitjacket. I was writing for somebody else according to their terms. I was making a living, but it wasn't creatively satisfying. And I was practicing writing, but not in the way I wanted. And then the internet arrived and the bottom completely fell out of that career. Print journalism and being a freelance print writer was no longer possible. The internet undermined the fees and everything. Just in a short version is my career disappeared and I needed time to renegotiate what I could do and how I could do it. And that became teaching, which evolved over several years. But and that then became very practical in that it opened. I had an income from teaching, but I didn't teach all the time. And that opened a place for much more creative writing. So I nostalgically say, look back at that time of becoming. I nostalgically look back at the incredible difficulty of writing this book, running up and down the stairs in my house, screaming because I couldn't figure it out. It was not easy to write. I look at it now and it's like it all is of a piece. Mm-hmm. So hard to figure out. But the book was becoming. And when I finished the book, I just said this to somebody, it felt like this beautiful butterfly I had caught and put in a glass case and put a pin in it. Yeah. And it was done.
Yeah.
And it was no longer something that was evolving and growing with me. So I think the difficulties, the hard times, yes, you can absolutely have nostalgia for, because it gives you a chance to become something new.
Because adversity, I mean, no one wants it. I mean, whether you're talking about, well, lockdown is a good example. Mm-hmm. No one wanted this. But having had to go through it, and I'm not talking about the people who've lost, you know, family members or I don't mean that.
But
for everybody, everyone's had to rethink the things that they have to do. And we have no choice in it. You know, in my case, it was literally a case of, you know, you can't teach your students tomorrow. You have to go online. And I'm like,
me too.
How do you do
from
that?
One day to the next, right? Well, we had 2 weeks to figure it out.
Yeah. And so with all these things going on, and it was like, this is horrible. But then you look back and you think, but if we hadn't had to do that, then, you know, we'd still be using the old paradigm, but it wasn't the old paradigm. It was the only paradigm. But then you suddenly realize, like, no, we wouldn't be talking now, because I was doing my interviews for people who either I was traveling to them physically, and obviously I was limited in terms of how far I could go, or they'd come to my office. And of course, now I'm interviewing people all over the world. And who'd have thought? So I look back, but see, that doesn't change my sense that, you know, I don't then think, I'm so glad that we had, you know, lockdown.
Not at all.
I don't think that at all. But it's happened again, you know, it's almost a case of this has happened and you have to deal with it, which is not the same thing as then saying, actually, it was good all along, because otherwise you're not doing justice to the struggles. You say, I got my degree or I wrote my book. Therefore, it's all okay.
It's all good. It was all
hardship was part of that.
Not at all. And the imagination doesn't go back and remake everything into a bed of roses.
Yeah.
You know, it just... Yeah. But you acknowledge that there is good that can come out of it. And those times, those problem-solving moments are really important. They're really important. It allows us to become more.
Yeah. No, you're right. And it's the same as we were saying earlier about, back to Hirith and, you know, presence and absence. In order to really appreciate something, you have to be away from it. You have to mourn something. You have to feel that displacement in order to understand the sense of value that it has all the more, you know, cogently.
Mary Oliver has something about loss is the beginning. Loss is the most important thing. Mm. And I think that's so true. In our case, we've discussed it. It's in a nutshell, there is no imagination without loss, right? There's no yearning to go back to Eden without having been kicked out of the garden.
Yeah. You can't have one without the other. Yeah, you can't have, and also you know that's why nostalgia, I think, is as much a forward looking or certainly a present oriented disposition as it is about the past. And I think that because it's about those values and those particular sort of trajectories that you're on. Two more questions, Pamela.
Okay.
One is about whether you've fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young. I suppose it's that whole question of, you know, intersecting with where you were, where you are now. Could you have imagined when you were younger what you would be doing with your life now?
That's funny. Have I fulfilled the dreams? Yes, in some ways, a simple answer. I mean, I think I grew up afraid to say I wanted to be a writer because it seemed like it was so beyond. My friends who are writers and I have there are a bunch of us that meet on Fridays and have a chat. We mostly talk about food, but we all say we're very uncomfortable when somebody asks us what we do. None of us admit we're writers because it seems so pretentious and obnoxious to say that, because we all grew up thinking that was the best thing we could ever do. And so to say that, it just seems wrong. And you know, you think of writer, you think of Shakespeare, not you. You can't share a noun with that man. But yes, I think my younger self would be happy. But as we grow up, those dreams change and evolve and become, and you yearn for the next and the next. Looking over, it's the Welsh geography, looking at the next hill and the next hill. You climb one and then still another recedes in the distance. And that's great. That's the beginning of my book. The epigraph at the beginning says, "Praise longing. It's what keeps us unfinished, not undone." And I think in a nutshell, maybe my 15-year-old self would be satisfied. But even my 25-year-old self couldn't say I wanted to be a creative writer. I could only be a journalist because that's all I thought I could do. And now I've done this, and this is a big thing. This book was a big thing for me. But now I want to do more. Now I want to do more with words and images. And I want my next book to involve that visual side. So there's always another goal.
You just made me think as well about, you know, how it is when you're younger and you imagine what the future is going to look like. And you think of films like, you know, one of the Back to the Future films, when the future is supposed to, like, we're all like traveling in the air, but then they still have newspapers. They still have a physical, it's as if they imagine that we were traveling through space. But actually, there's no internet, and we still actually, you know, get the newspaper, and we actually, you know, put the money in the coin machine. And of course, that's the funny thing, because it's actually the other way around. You know, we're still traveling on the ground, but everything's online. So again, it's deeply funny, but also but when we first saw that, we didn't laugh then. We only laugh now because we know that the period in between has actually not gone the way that Robert Zemeckis' imagination thought it would.
Exactly. Oh, right. I love that.
My very last question, Pamela. Okay. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I can answer this different ways. Hmm. Personally, I'm looking forward, but I also carry the past with me all the time. There's not a day goes by that I don't smell a smell or feel a breeze, like in Maine, where we're on vacation. The heavy sea breeze made me in two places at once. I was right back in Lampeter. I was right back in Aberaeron. And I talk to my parents who've died. I talk to them all the time in my head. So I carry the past with me. But in larger terms, I'm not the kind of person, a friend asked me that, like last year, would you go to see the future or would you go to the past? I would go to the past. The future, it will happen. It will happen without us. Mm. And I hope we can leave the planet in a better place for the future. I hope we do all we can for that now. But I've always been interested in the past. And like, what was it really like? And to leave on a Lampeter note, there's a scene early in the book where I used to go for these walks at dusk, that liminal moment between night and day, and stand on the edge of a field and wonder, fiercely wonder, what happened in this place? 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago, something did. This is a place that has this incredible history that my place where I grew up didn't have. I didn't have access to that. But now, like, my imagination clicked on and it wasn't present. It was absent. Mm-hmm. But I knew that there were indications of the past. There were ruins. There were, from what I read, I knew something had happened here. The names, the place names told me. Fanbera Rapan Stefan told me that there was Peter's Bridge at Stephen's Church, even though it wasn't present. And that both made me want to go back, but also want to go forward in my head. So it's, again, holding those two things at once.
Yeah, that is a perfect answer. Pamela, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Chris, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you. I've enjoyed every minute. I truly have.